You're listening to Birth Babies
and Busy Moms.
I'm Kia.
And I'm Dana.
We're two busy, sleep-deprived moms discussing different stages of motherhood,
providing personal experiences and guest speakers to empower and educate mothers around the world,
helping and supporting them to make informed decisions and to let you know
you're not alone. I know.
Slamming. Welcome back, everyone, and today we have a very special guest. It's Debbie Fazio, who's the president and founder of Precious Moments Babies. She also has a wide range of other certificates and education that I'll let Kia quickly touch upon.
She's co-founder and faculty for the Global Perinatal Support Worker Program that's offered at Mohawk College. She also is a nonprofit organization leader of Family Roots Alliance. And she has a couple of other certifications, and she's a newborn care specialist, a doula, a sleep consultant, and has a wealth of knowledge that enables her to support families with a wide range of baby and child-related issues.
It truly is amazing to see how educated she is.
I think she just kept getting more specialized and more specialized. And she knows a lot. Like, she is very well known in the baby and mom community in Hamilton. And I think over 6 people told me that I need to connect with her.
Well, I'm really excited that we have her on our podcast here today to share all of her knowledge and experience in the baby field. And especially, I've never even heard of a perinatal support worker before. So I'm really excited to learn more about that as well.
I think that's what caught my eye too when I heard that. I was like, what is that? Because I've never heard of it before. And I want to know what it is, because where were those things when we had kids, right? Because I never had that or even knew that was a resource possible.
Yeah, and it's great too because it's another resource that new moms or seasoned moms can put in their little toolbox when they need assistance or help. And I agree, it sucks that we didn't have that or know of it when we were going through it, but it's awesome to know that this is a resource that people can access and they don't have to go through what we went through.
Yeah, I'm honestly super interested to all she has to offer too. And I think when you have that holistic approach of a bunch of different areas and not just one, it's the support's even better, right?
Oh, of course. And very educated help, which a lot of moms need.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's get into it with Debbie. So welcome, Debbie.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we'd love for you to introduce yourself, given that you do many different things.
Sure. I started my journey in the parenting, new and expecting world just over 20 years ago. I trained as a postpartum doula. I have 3 children of my own, 3 of them under 2. And that really was what inspired me to want to support other parents who were having babies. I felt like for my own journey, the ball was dropped. And I thought, you know, what can I do to make a difference for someone else? And I felt like taking a postpartum doula course at the time was the best approach. So I started off by supporting new and expecting families. And from there, it was just me at the time. And we grew very quickly. So I started an agency. This was 21 years ago now, as of April. And we offer different types of support from education classes to pregnancy and labor support, right through to postpartum in-home day and overnight care. And we have a team of over 40 professionals ranging from nurses, doulas, and perinatal support workers. And along the way of having an agency, I really realized that the training I received was not substantial or comprehensive enough to be able to support families. So I partnered with my partner, Virginia, and her and I created the Perinatal Support Worker Program, which is currently taught at Mohawk College. And that is a comprehensive program taught to PSWs who want to support new and expecting families. And it really teaches them everything from fertility and pregnancy right through to the first year of life. So that's sort of been our journey, is helping parents with the support side and then helping professionals to make sure that they're properly trained to be able to support those parents.
Wow, that's amazing. So when you initially had the first training to become a postpartum doula, what did that kind of look like? You said it wasn't sufficient enough in your personal experience. So what did that look like, the training?
Yeah, so it was a 2-day weekend training in someone's living room. It felt a little bit biased to one side. There were certain things that they didn't want to teach or talk about. And when I went to do my first shift with a family, even though I was a mom of three, I really felt unprepared because I learned a lot about the postpartum, but I didn't learn anything about the pregnancy and birth. And there's so much, I'm sure you both can agree, there's so much that happens during pregnancy and birth that can affect, our postpartum or postnatal journey. So I just really felt unprepared. Even though I was a new mom, I really only knew my own pregnancy journey and my own birth journey. So it just didn't prepare me enough. And there were so many scenarios that I felt parents were struggling with that I didn't know about and ended up having to do a lot of extra trainings and learnings on my own. So the doula training gave me kind of a basic overview, but it didn't really give me enough to support the families the way they needed to. And it took me going outside of that to gain that extra knowledge.
Okay, and then so after the 2-day course that you had, was there a certificate that you had?
There was, yes, they give you a certificate. At the time, you would just get a training certificate that you took the training, and then you would have to go get some experience with clients before you could submit that and get your actual trained, registered doula certificate. But it really was just experiential on top of the 2-day training.
So how long did you go before you started doing more certifications and trainings?
It was right away. I felt like right away this wasn't enough. So I started to take things like breastfeeding courses, how to make formula properly for parents who chose to go that route, how to deal with babies who had gas and colic, how to properly swaddle babies. I took a sleep certification course, a newborn care specialist course. So I probably had to take an extra 10 different certifications on my own to feel like, okay, now I know enough to be able to support families. And I think one of the biggest things that I wasn't taught that was my biggest takeaway is also if I don't know the answer, to know how to go get it. There's so many experts out there and professionals, and I think that's a big thing right now is we cannot be the master of all trades. So I think an important thing and what we teach our students is not only how to know a little bit about everything, but also where to go get information and where to go find the professional. So if you are encountering a family who has a special need, to know where to go find that because there are so many professionals out there for parents that they don't even know about existing. And that's part of our job as people supporting those families is to show them what else is available for help.
So, how did you find these additional accreditations?
Well, at the time there wasn't Google, so it was like a lot of deep dive in AOL. But there was a lot of community things that were available, in-person type community center trainings. The newborn care specialist ultimately was something that I did find online, and I did take that training. But it was just really researching. As you can imagine, 20 years ago, it wasn't a quick Google search to find a doula program or a perinatal support worker program. It was a lot more to investigate to try and find those. Now it feels like there's a course happening on every corner, literally.
And I think too, it's hard for people who want to get into that line of work, but they don't know where to start, where to begin, and kind of like what the path looks like. So, what would you say for someone who wants to get into what you do? What should their first step be?
Yeah, well, what I tell parents really, if this goes for the professionals as well, is what's your end goal? What type of professional do you want to be? And go find a training that's going to support that. I mentioned earlier that I found that at the time, the doula training was very one-sided for me. It focused heavily on breastfeeding. And we were learning a lot about if you chose not to breastfeed, then we can't support parents like that. And that to me just felt wrong. So had I had known that that training was all about that, I probably wouldn't have taken it. So find something that's going to help you be the best professional for the families that you want to support. So if you want to support families who bottle feed or breastfeed or use cloth diapers or disposable or choose to sleep train versus co-sleeping, then find a course that is going to teach you a little bit about all of those components so that we can ultimately give those tools to our parents. Because if a parent is saying to you, what are the pros and cons to co-sleeping or sleep training? We shouldn't be telling them which one to choose. We should be able to provide them the information so that they can make that informed decision. It's their choice. So, as professionals, we really should have the information of all the pieces. And I think that's a key is if you're thinking about getting into this line of work, to make sure that you're finding a course that's going to teach you a comprehensive, non-judgmental approach that we can authentically support the clients that we're working with.
Yeah, and I think that is so important, especially like that's why me and Dana, I think, clicked so well, is we both have different insights and different views on parenting, but we respect one another and we don't look down upon any decision either one of us makes. And like she chooses to sleep train, and she was successfully sleep training her first child and in the mix of the second one, and she'll kind of get into that. But I just co-slept with both of my children. I did try to sleep train with my son, but as I continued and tried to do it, and he wasn't responding to it, I knew, okay, there's something wrong. But I had this societal pressure of, okay, something's obviously not going well if he's not sleeping. And everyone's telling me, just let him cry it out. And consistently telling me this over and over again. Eventually, I caved and tried it, and later was diagnosed with C. difficile and all these other issues. And I never knew there was like a link to it. I never knew that iron deficiency causes babies to have sleep issues. And there's so many different things other than just putting the baby there to cry or whatever form you choose, right?
I agree. Sleep training is one of the biggest controversial topics for most new parents. And one thing I've noticed over the years is it's almost become a milestone. Parents think that at some point, okay, my baby is sitting, my baby's rolling over, now we sleep train. It's not a milestone. It's a tool, and it's there if and when you choose to use it. And I think that as parents and professionals, we need to stop the judgment. Like it's none of our business if you choose to sleep train or not to sleep train. And any professional out there who is teaching parents to do that should be mindful of that. When parents ask me when is the best time to sleep train, obviously we have minimums. Your child doesn't need to be a specific age, but the best time to sleep train is if and when you're ready. That's the best time. And if you're not ready, then don't do it because it's going to be worse for you on the other end. And more importantly, both parents have to be on the same page. If you've got parents who are conflicting with whether to sleep train or not, baby senses all that. So it's got to be something you want to do, something you're comfortable with. And no parent should feel forced or pressured to doing that. It's so controversial. And that's the same with every newborn care. Breastfeeding and bottle feeding, another big one. It doesn't matter. What is that of anyone's business of what you're choosing? And I know this is an issue because I will ask parents if I'm doing a sleep consultation. That was one thing I didn't mention. I am a certified sleep consultant. But I'll ask parents, are you bottle feeding or breastfeeding? And I never get just an answer. I get an answer and an explanation. Oh, I'm bottle feeding, but I tried to breastfeed for 2 weeks and then the reasoning why. And I always tell parents, I don't need the reason why. It's your choice and that should not matter. But just getting that answer from parents in that way makes me realize that we are feeling like we're being judged because we did it a specific way. Does that make sense?
Oh, that completely makes sense. And I knew that feeling very well with my first because I supplemented with my first. So I breastfed, but also formula fed. And I felt the pressure from society without anyone even saying anything to me. I just felt, oh, I should be fully breastfeeding and I should slowly wean her off of the bottle. I never did because my milk wasn't coming in properly due to the trauma and everything that went on with my birth. But it's just ingrained in our heads, even before I became pregnant or gave birth, that like women, you're supposed to, I'm doing quotation marks on this, breastfeed because they think breast is best. Well, there's so many other factors involved, and the baby just needs to be fed. Whatever way the mom feels is best, I truly believe that is the best way. And there's no right answer, right? Except
You're
for
bang
the
on.
mom has the right answer.
You're bang on. The breast, I'm going to use the air quotes too. Breast is best. That statement can hurt. Just
It
that
can.
statement. Before you even get pregnant, we're already bombarded with breast is best. So anything else, that means something's wrong with it. And that's not in every scenario. We've had clients that we've worked with that, they were being medicated for postpartum depression. And sometimes they needed to sleep a certain amount of hours overnight. So they couldn't breastfeed sometimes because of the medication. Sometimes they couldn't breastfeed because they had to sleep a certain amount of hours to be able to function in the day for their baby. And they were carrying that guilt. And that just from the very beginning, we're making parents and moms feel so bad just by some of the taglines that we're using.
Oh, for sure. And I think a big part of this too is mental health of the mother. And I know in my situation, my mental health and even physical health from all the trauma I went through, I wasn't in a place to put the pressure of breastfeeding because it takes up all of your energy, all of your nutrients. And it honestly made me in a worse mental state. And I wasn't the mother I wanted to be because of the pressures of breastfeeding. And I think that a present mother and a happy mother truly creates a happy child. So
100%. I
this
agree.
is just the issue that I encountered. And I know that a lot of listeners even might be going through the same thing. But it's so hard to step back and realize, like, okay, this is best for me, especially when you have all those pressures.
Agree with you. And that is one of the biggest things when we're interviewing new team members. That's one of the questions. It's kind of a trick question when I ask them, but I say, so what's your philosophy around birth or parenting? And as soon as they dive into their philosophy, we don't want them on our team because it's not about them. It's not about their philosophy. Their philosophy is their own parenting journey. It does not apply to anyone else. So, of course, if a family can breastfeed and it's successful, amazing. But if we have parents, like I'll tell you a little bit about my journey with my first daughter. I was, the first out of all my friends and even my family to have a baby in a long time. And I didn't really have that support. Everyone just assumed that I was going to breastfeed, and I did. And I did not have very much support. I didn't even know breastfeeding consultants 26 years ago. The hospital had sent me home without even telling me about that. So I went home, and for 3 months, I remember my husband chasing me around the house with our daughter. And every time she was at the breast, it was excruciatingly painful. My nipples were cracked. They were bleeding into her mouth. I remember her pulling away and blood being like all over her lips and her face. And I did that for about 3 months and I hated it. And I remember going to the doctor, and when the doctor said, "How's everything going?" I burst down into tears crying. And the doctor just said, "Then why don't you stop?" And I swear, when the doctor said that to me, this weight lifted off of my shoulders, like, oh my God. Someone said, "I can stop. It's not the worst thing if my daughter ends up on a bottle." And I think that's where really we need to be so much more graceful with new and expecting parents, that it doesn't matter. I mean, your baby is not going to get sick and die if you choose a bottle, whether it's one bottle a day or whether it's all bottles. It's not the end of the world. So, really, like you said, Dana, it's about how you're feeling. And as a new mom, if using a bottle or co-sleeping or sleep training, or using disposable diapers instead of cloth diapers makes you feel like a better mother or better parent, then that's the best choice for you. And no one should be saying anything or judging you for it.
And I think there's just this huge like social stigma of what you choose will always come with something, right? And like where I'm from, I like with my group of friends as well, I'm also like the first to have kids and stuff. So they don't understand anything. So I mean, some of my really close friends aren't judgmental at all because they don't understand it. They're just like, oh, okay, whatever. And but then also there's people in my life that have been like, well, if breastfeeding is so hard on you, well, why don't you just bottle feed? And I remember everyone giving me such a hard time for not bottle feeding, actually. So I think there's both ways to it. Even when my son got diagnosed with FPIES at 10 months old, my doctor asked me, "Do you want to keep breastfeeding or do you want to stop? What is your goal?" And I said, "I want to keep breastfeeding, obviously, but I still want to look at other ways." And they told me that there was a formula that my son could take, but that it was backlogged. Like it was very hard to get because you needed a prescription for it. This was during COVID and there was all of those recalls. So formula alone was really hard to get. And he said, "Right now, it's probably not the best choice to do it. Around a year old, maybe try it out." But then when the year came, I wasn't able to get that prescription because the doctor took me off as his patient, or my son as his patient. But then I seen a lactation consultant for the very first time when he was about 2 years old because I needed him to stop breastfeeding. And again, that social stigma. Well, he's two now. Why are you still breastfeeding? He's way too old. Even when he was turned a year old, I got a lot of backlash from basically everyone in my life being like, why are you still breastfeeding? There's no benefits to it. That doesn't make sense. Like, that's why he doesn't sleep at night. That's why he's so attached to you. But it's like, don't you want your kid to be attached to you?
You know, I think the key is this. I personally, as an example, I cannot hold a baby for a long period of time. I get hot. I get anxious. I need the baby to be able to be put down and be able to go to the bathroom or take a shower. I can't have that physical like touch for too long. What does that have to do with you and your baby? Right?
Exactly.
What does that have to do with you guys? That's me. That's how I feel. And I think that's the key. If you want to co-sleep with your kid till they're 18, like, that's your business. That's not our business, right? The sad thing is sometimes I have to tell parents to don't share. That's a sad thing is if you feel like you need to defend yourself in a space, maybe that's not the space you should be sharing. You know, I felt sometimes even with my own sister where she would call me and she would share some stuff with me that happened with a circle of her friends. And she was really frustrated about it. And I said, then stop sharing with them. Like, if that's not your people and you feel badly when you walk away from that, then don't share that information. So unfortunately, I think we as parents have to realize too, like where we can feel safe sharing and where we maybe don't want to share, because we shouldn't have to be put in a position to defend ourselves. And I was just going to say, and when it comes to immediate family, because I know sometimes it's our moms, our sisters, our best friend, our partners, you just have to stand your ground and say, this is my choice. If you don't like it, that's your problem, not mine.
Well, and it's interesting too that you mention this, because Kia and I had this conversation about last week, and I think you even mentioned it in your podcast, Kia, is that you started lying to people about what you were doing, depending on their beliefs. So if someone said, oh, like, are you breastfeeding? And they are wholeheartedly believe that every woman should be breastfeeding, she just says yes. Oh, is your baby sleeping in a crib? You just said yes, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that, actually. It's like when you get to a point, and I don't know if it was just like the second child, I don't care what other people say, but I was just kind of like, you know what? If I lie, how are they going to know? They're not around. Even if they are around, I can just say, oh, well, this is different for this time or whatever. And like finding those people that appreciate your different styles of parenting make such a difference. And even with my first, I didn't really join mom groups. I didn't really have lots of mom friends because of that stigma or that judgmental aspect of it. And it actually wasn't until I came to Ottawa, I met Dana and a few of our other friends, where I started feeling like, okay, I found my tribe. I found the moms that we all do things differently, but at the end of the day, we're focused on a happy mom and a happy child. And that's when I started realizing that like there are communities that have the same understanding.
I agree. We talk about this a lot when we're teaching about professional development, not necessarily parenting, but we teach this about professional development, is find the people that know your worth, find the people that have the same, you know, theories and goals as you do, find the people that are going to not judge you. And that's the same with parenting. Like, we need the village, right? We need that village to be supportive, not to judge us or make us feel inferior because of our choices. Another big one is the attachment parenting. I hate that phrase so much. And I have been talking about that for 20 years, because what is the opposite of attachment? Disattachment? Like, it doesn't make sense. So just using that phrase alone, if you're an attachment parent, people will judge you, because that means you're like always with your baby, never go out, always breastfeeding, co-sleeping, holding them all the time. And if you're a disattached parent, I call it the nurturing parent or the nurtured parent, just to make it sound a little nicer. But just because we put our baby down in a swing so that I can go to the bathroom doesn't make me a bad mom. Just because No. I leave them with my mother so that I can go out for dinner with my husband doesn't make me a bad mom. Just because I decide to give a bottle once a day doesn't make me a bad mom. No different than if you're co-sleeping, if you are baby wearing, like, who cares? At the end of the day, our goal is to give them love and compassion and teach them skills to be able to be productive adults. You know, my kids had both sides. I'll tell you a quick little funny story. I sleep trained my first daughter. I remember her sleeping with us. She was 4 months old. And she had this little baby, had the entire bed, and my husband and I were on the edges with our arms hanging on the side tables. And we looked at each other thinking, like, what are we doing? This is insane. So I sleep trained her. Thank God I sleep trained her, because when she was 10 months, I found out I was pregnant with twins. Can I tell you guys though, that 15 years later, I found out, I didn't know this, but when my twins were really little, there was a few nights where my older daughter woke up in the middle of the night and my husband saw how tired I was. He went to her room, sat on the floor with his hand through the rails of the crib, and held her fingers so she fell back asleep. I probably would have had a meltdown if I knew that then, but I didn't even notice. Took me 15 years of him telling me that that happened, right? So that's why it doesn't matter. I think at the end of the day, what works for every family is the key. Making sure that you're comfortable with what you're doing, not letting other people make you feel inferior or badly about it, not sharing if you're worried that people are going to judge you. Don't share with those people. Their opinions don't matter anyways. Honestly, if parents are asking you, if you're finding friends and family asking you what you're doing, genuinely because they want to learn. Because you might have that. You mentioned earlier that you have some friends who weren't. Didn't have children at the time. So they may have asked you, are you breastfeeding or bottle feeding? Genuinely, because they wanted to understand and learn. Great. But if you know that's going to come back with some judgment, it's none of their business. And it's okay for you to say that. What difference is it if I'm breastfeeding or bottle feeding?
And I think it's important to note too that every woman's threshold is different for certain things as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that's right through pregnancy and postpartum, like right for birth. Some people love their pregnancies and their birth. Some people will never do it again. You're right. I think the thresholds are different. And we have to also remember there is, in a lot of cases, a partner in the mix. So you want to also make sure you're on the same page. You have to have that discussion. If you're wanting to be a co-sleeping parent, don't forget there is another parent. So you want to talk to each other to discuss how can we make this work as a family. Because you certainly don't want to have friction right in your immediate circle. Right. So that's a discussion. If you can do it early on, great. But at the very least, when you've had a baby, that's something that you will have to discuss and figure out too.
It's funny you say that actually, because I was just watching a video or something and someone was saying about dating questions and that nobody talks about sleep training when they go on dates and no one talks about breastfeeding, bottle feeding. Like when they think about having kids, they just think, do you want kids? Yes or no? How many kids do you want? Nobody really talks about the 100 other aspects of having children. And then when you get put in that position of, okay, now we have kids. Now we haven't slept through the night in 4 months, let's say. What route are we going to go? But then a lot of times people start listening to the outer voices, right? Which it's common and it's not necessarily normal, but people just listen to other people's advices or concerns. And I think that it definitely like shifts a narrative in a negative way.
So here's the best part about this, okay? Somebody asks you what parent, kind of parent you are. You know what's the best part about that? You can change your mind, right? You
Yes,
can be a
yes.
co-sleeping parent and a attachment parent for 6 months and then decide, yeah, I think this is good now. I think we can move on to some independent sleep and maybe giving a bottle here and there. Like that's the beauty of this is that maybe talking about it when you're dating might not be the best conversation to be having with a new interest, but it doesn't matter because you will change your mind. I mean, I tell this to all my own family and friends. I tell this to my own daughters. You know, if you choose to breastfeed and you don't choose to breastfeed, it doesn't matter because you can change along the way. You might want, I mean, I know families who have said, we're going to do a bottle right off the bat. We're doing a bottle. They have the baby and now they're like, maybe I'm going to try the breasts and see how that goes. Right. So, and I think that's a key, especially with breastfeeding, because I think with breastfeeding, we take that as a personal insult or personal failure if it doesn't work out. Try. Don't put the pressure on yourself of whether it succeeds or fails. Try it. If that's something you want to try and it works, great. And if it doesn't work, oh well, move on to the next thing you're going to try. So that's the beauty of this is that you can change your mind along the journey. You don't have to be specifically one parent for the entire time. You can change your mind as you go.
I think too that when you are breastfeeding or when you are doing all these things, that you go into it assuming you're going to do one thing. And I don't know about you guys, but what I said I was going to do in pregnancy is so different than what I did the moment I gave birth.
Yeah, and I think it's so important to remain flexible thinking rather than rigid, because everything changes. The pregnancy, things change during that. Birth especially, so many things could go wrong or so many things could go well. And it's just like leaving room for the unexpected and leaving room that choices can change at any point. And going back to the sleep situation we were talking about. So I actually co-slept with my first for 6 months, actually more like 5.5 months. And it caused a rift in my relationship. My mental health wasn't well at that point. And I just had a breaking point where I knew that I needed to get a sleep coach. So I got a sleep coach and everything she shared with me was great. But at the very end of it, what I figured out I had to do was let my baby cry it out completely. Because every time, so she was suggesting the check-ins. Every time I did a check-in, my baby responded poorly to that and would cry even longer and longer. And it just extended for hours. So then I kind of remained flexible with my thinking that, okay, I need to adapt to the situation and adapt to my child's needs, which I'm the mother, I know best. And what I did is I just completely let her cry it out. Was it painful? Because a lot of moms, obviously, that's not the route they want to go, and that's great, and I respect that. But for me, like I mentioned before, my mental health wasn't good. My relationship wasn't good. I needed to do this to become a good mom, to strengthen my relationship, to also have that good bond with my child. Because co-sleeping with her, we both weren't really sleeping. She was latched to my boob the entire time. So I think that's just another important thing to note is like, change can happen and choices can change, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just where you are at your life in that point might be going a different direction than it was before.
Agreed. And Dana, like sleep training is hard. It's hard. When I hear parents, anyone for that matter, say that that is the easy way out, I'm like, what are you even talking about? Like sleep training is just as hard as co-sleeping. They both have their drawbacks and they both have their advantages. But again, it's one of those things, like you said, be flexible with your journey. If you're going to go into pregnancy and parenting with a very specific path, I wish you all the best, because your baby did not read that book. Your baby does not know what your plan is. So you have to be flexible. And we've only talked about the first one. Like what happens when you have a second and third child? That's going to change entirely, because maybe the time commitment and energy you gave to having one child isn't possible with two or three. So now I see parents who are on their second and third baby, and now the guilt comes with, I didn't breastfeed my second for as long, or I didn't co-sleep with my second, but I did with my first. Even all the way to, I didn't even take as many pictures of my third as I did with my first two. So it's going to change. Like, let's give ourselves that grace. There is no instruction. There is no right and wrong. It's only what works and what works for you. And that's the key. I think that's a big takeaway on this podcast for sure, is try not to go in with such a rigid plan of what you think it's going to look like, because you're going to be disappointed. And that disappointment is going to affect your mental health in the end.
Oh, for sure. And then also, it changes with each kid. So one kid could respond to the sleep training, and then you have another kid who's not responding to sleep training. So for my second child, I didn't have to sleep train her until recently, but it didn't even work. And I just gave up on it, to be honest. And I am more lenient, I would say, with my second, because I feel like it could be potentially my last child. So I savor those moments more. Whereas with my first, I didn't savor those moments. I was dreading those moments. She was also a colic baby too, so that gets thrown in there as well. So it's just a very different bond with both children. And yeah, they don't respond to the same thing. They're totally different. It's just crazy to see the differences. So it's not only the like threshold for the parents, but it's also for the children.
Absolutely. You're going to appreciate that boldness and character in her when she's older, right? Because they need that fight as they age. But I did a lot of volunteering in my kids' schools. And I will tell you, if you're going to focus on anything, Maybe focus on the practical things like teaching your little one how to put their coat and shoes on their own so that when they go to school, they're not now thrown in a room with 40 children and no one there to put their coat and shoes on. That's probably a bigger focus than whether or not your kid was sleep trained at 4 months or at 12 months or at 2 or that sort of thing. And it, you know, if you are rocking your child's sleep at 3 and it works for you, then it works for you. Some people love that affection. Like some adults love that one-on-one connection. They thrive on it. And if it's working for the family, great, keep doing it. I mean, I don't think you're going to be doing that with your child when he's 18. It's going to stop. Eventually, it's going to stop. Maybe not.
I could only hope.
But in all honesty, I think the goal as parents is to love them, make sure that they are nurtured, make sure that they are fed, that they're cared for, that they're given affection, that they're taught things like empathy and compassion. They're taught practical things, like I said, putting their coat and shoes on so that they can be successful in the world. But we put so much energy and focus in these things that really are not going to make that big of an impact on your child, especially if you're miserable. Like if you're a miserable mother and you're breastfeeding and you're co-sleeping, I don't know who that's helping.
So kind of on that line, so do you see, like working with these people postpartum, do you see a connection between a colicky baby and a mom who's going through it, let's say? Because I truly believe that when the mom is struggling and isn't getting help, I feel like that definitely like gets put onto baby, where I've kind of asked Dana this before, like, do you think your trauma response after your first kind of like went through your breast milk, kind of to speak, right?
Well, your energy is for sure contagious. So how you're feeling as a parent is going to impact your little one. I wouldn't say necessarily colic. It could just be that they're feeling that emotion. So, you know, if you have a mom who's got a really fussy baby and the baby's crying and mom's anxious and trying to get that baby to calm down, it's almost like it's not going to work because that exchange of energy, you're just giving your baby that anxiety and energy back. So I'll tell parents, it's okay to put your baby down in the crib, put them somewhere safe, go step out of the room, take a deep breath. If you guys look at Shaken Baby or the Purple Cry, they have some great resources for parents out there. But they tell parents, you have permission to put your baby down in a safe place and leave. Nothing's going to happen to them. The far more bad things could happen if you keep trying in that moment. So I agree with you 100%. Your energy will definitely impact your little one and how they're feeling. So if you go out of the room, have a tea, go outside and get some fresh air, take a few really good cleansing breaths, then come back when you have a calmer energy and try and calm your baby down, you're probably going to have way more success than if you didn't do it.
And I completely agree with that, because there was definitely moments during my daughter's colic that I wanted to shake her. I would even text my partner, "You need to come home from work. Like, I'm going to shake our child." Because these were just the emotions I was feeling. I was overwhelmed, but also one thing that I never did was put her down. And I held her for those 5 hours straight. She's screaming in my ear. I'm overstimulated. It was almost a year that I had done that. And I also had the trauma bond to her, so I think this is why I wasn't putting her down. And I allowed myself to get to those points, but I still never put her down. And one thing I wish I knew is that it's okay to let your kid cry, and if nothing is calming them down, put them in a safe space and walk away. Because that was honestly the most torture I've been through in my life.
Yeah, you know, I think the problem is we're fixers. We need to fix everything. So if my baby's crying, I have to stop her from crying. And you do get into that moment where you're like, I'm so done. Like, I'm just leaving. I'm done with this. I don't want to be in this energy anymore. So acknowledge that feeling and put your baby down. Can't tell you when you put your baby down, especially if you get them swaddled in a dark room with a white noise machine, put them down, leave, go take a deep breath. And I bet you in that few minutes that you step away, the baby will actually calm down. But you're right, we keep trying this overstimulating approach, which is not working. So put them down or pass them on to someone else. Like if you are fortunate enough to have help, call in that help. I teach parents this thing called the job jar. And I tell them right from when they're pregnant and anytime they're, even after they've had their baby, whenever they have things on their mind of what they need to do or get done to put things in that job jar. Clean my Tupperware cabinet, take my dog for a walk, clean my linen drawers, whatever it is. And when people come over to help, give them a job. So when they say, "What can I do to help you out?" most of us will be like, "No, nothing. We want to have our house perfectly cleaned and I'm handling it all. I'm like a princess. I'm doing it all by myself." Tell them they want to genuinely help, give them a task. And that's no different when it comes to you needing help. You calling someone, a friend, a neighbor, a mom, a volunteer, or even a professional if you have to hire them to come in, it doesn't make you less of a mom because you needed help. And in fact, I tell people now because they weren't understanding. I was trying to be really delicate and nice when I said to them, "It's okay to get help. It's okay," because I felt like that phrase was telling them that, well, if they need it, it's there. And now I flat out tell them, if you're trying to do it by yourself, you're doing it wrong. Like, period. This was never meant to be done alone. And if you're trying, you are 100% doing it wrong. So call everybody you know, get them on that phone tree, and get them to help you. And if you're feeling like your little one is crying a lot, colicky, gassy, whatever is going on, call someone to come help you. You are not supposed to do this by yourself. You're setting yourself up for failure.
Oh, I completely agree with that. And going back to what you do as a perinatal support worker, I've never even heard of that. So I would love to learn a little bit more about that and the kind of training that you provide those workers. Because for me, if I knew of that back when I had my first child, I would have used one, right? I would have had one for sure because I didn't have the support systems around me. I lived in Alberta, all my family was in Ontario. So it's just nice to have those options.
I agree. A lot of insurance companies are now starting to cover this type of care. So if you or any of your listeners have access to the underwriters in insurance companies, you need to tell them to start to look at this because it is, again, like I mentioned, it's not a perk, it's a need. So perinatal support workers, they get 6 months of training. It's 500 hours that they're learning on. I mean, there's so many things from the history of childbirth to maternal and infant physiology and anatomy. They're learning about all things pregnancy and childbirth. They learn about water birth and how to provide that to clients. They're learning about maternal and infant mental health. They learn about everything postpartum, and they're learning from not just one educator, there's 10 of them. So they're getting it from a registered dietitian, registered massage therapist on how to deal with things like teething, gas and colic, irritability with the bowels, even a baby who's constipated, and how that can be helped and supported by parents. Swaddling, safe sleep. They're learning about hypnobirthing, being mindful during pregnancy and parenting. They're learning how to support partners, both in childbirth and in the postpartum period or postnatal period. So they're really learning a lot. They're learning everything up until the first year of life, breastfeeding, bottle feeding, starting solids, all of those things throughout. And if they don't know something, they know the professional who does. So they're part of that support system, that educated support system that can help you with the hands-on. But they also are very well connected with the communities and who else can help you. Sometimes babies cry simply. I don't know if you knew this, but if your baby was born via vaginal birth but used with a suction or forceps, it can misalign the cranial caps in the baby's skull. And when they're born, those cranial caps are very fluid and kind of loose. They're not fused together yet. And in the first year, they then fuse together and they become the hard bones in our head. But if they've been suctioned or forcepsed, those bones can sometimes misalign, and that can cause discomfort and it can cause your baby to cry. And if you don't know that, how would you know to go see a cranial sacral therapist? How would you know that that could be the reason why your little one's crying? So we teach our PNSWs that if you've got a crying baby, here are all the things to consider that are very homeopathic that maybe are not even medical issues that can just be simply fixed with a little bit of maneuvering. That's not something that we do, but we can connect them with a sacrocranial therapist that can help them. So there's so many pieces that a 2-day, 16-hour weekend course could not possibly give us. So the PNSWs have these 500 hours of theory, and then they have 400 hours of practicum where they're actually working hands-on with parents and being able to apply that theory before they can be registered.
And I think it's important to note too is that so I had a forceps delivery and I was never told that information. And you guys have a wealth of knowledge that we need to be using that even doctors aren't providing individuals, which they should be, because this is a medical issue that you mentioned. So there's something wrong with the medical world
Well,
right
I
now.
agree. I think the problem is they just don't have enough time to teach everything. They're focused so much on the birth and the first 6 weeks. They're really not focusing on the other things, especially the homeopathic things, right? Not every baby who's crying means something's wrong. Sometimes it could be something like the cranial caps are misaligned and can use that manipulation. Some babies are, maybe parents aren't sure how to know if they've eaten enough, and maybe the baby's not being fed properly, or maybe they just need some swaddling done correctly because they're just, their startle reflux is affecting them. There's so many pieces, and that's where we focus on giving the PNSWs, even though it might just be a little piece of it, enough to know that could be the issue. We teach them even about something called DEMER. I don't know if either of you have heard that. DMER. Yes, one of you is nodding your head. Yeah. DEMER is something that happens when a mom is breastfeeding. It's this complete just taking over of your entire body where you just all of a sudden feel like a major shift to depression. You just feel like completely overwhelmed and sad. This feeling that you couldn't imagine, it happens when the letdown happens. And then after a few minutes, it's gone. And so many parents feel like that, or people even tell them that that's postpartum depression. You're going through postpartum depression, when really it's a physiological response to the letdown. So even something as small as that, we don't go into details with the PNSW to tell them how to heal it and the entire physiological process, but we at least spend a few minutes teaching them what it is so that if a parent has that issue, and I'll tell you, in the 20 years that I've been doing this, I've probably had five moms who have gone through that DEMER. But do you know how they felt when they learned what it was and that it wasn't postpartum depression? That overwhelming feel of relief that there wasn't something wrong with them, that it was just an immediate. So they learned how to deal with that because we were able to connect them with a professional who could teach them how to do that.
It's funny that you brought that up because I always like talk about this influencer person, Francesca Farago, I think that's how you say it. And she's actually one who posted about it, and that's how I knew what it was. And there's like this connection that a lot of people don't know about it because it's considered rare, like in quotations, rare. And again, people don't speak about it. And like I think I was saying this to you, Dana, like all these things that I want Francesca to come on our podcast because she's gone through so many different things. And I think that when you make light of things that are going on in your life that most people wouldn't speak about, let's say, that it actually makes the conversation keep going. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think too, though, mentioning about the depression and the DEMER, I actually had something similar, but it wasn't depression. So every time that I was breastfeeding my second child, I think this happened around the 6 week mark, I started getting rage and my whole body would be consumed and I would be agitated. I didn't want to be touched. I just wanted her to unlatch immediately. And it was just this uncontrollable anger. And I just didn't know what was happening. I never really researched about it. I didn't look into it too much, but it lasted about 3 or 4 weeks, and those were 3 or 4 weeks of torture. And she didn't take bottles, so I was stuck breastfeeding my child that I didn't want to be breastfeeding at the time. And it was weird.
Yeah, and it could have been a form of DEMER. And sometimes there's no fix, but acknowledging and knowing what it is a fix enough, right? That's the big key takeaway is just understanding what is happening to you is sometimes enough to help you get through it. Because when we don't know, that's with anything in life, but we don't know why something's happening, it just makes us even more anxious and more frustrated. But sometimes if you're able to give a title to it, or an understanding of why it's happening, it just makes you feel better. Unfortunately, many people don't know about some of these things. So that's why for me, it's important. I want to be able to, when I'm working with a client, if something's going on, I want to be able to at least, if I can't answer the question of what's happening, I want to be able to at least find it or find someone who can help you.
Yeah, and that's like what our goal is just to have these conversations, because everybody always thinks it's a black or white. It's either you have a great pregnancy, great birth, great postpartum, or it's bad, but nobody ever asks why. And like my partner would always say, well, it's rude to ask somebody if they say like they're having a hard time, or you know, but it's like if they're saying to you, oh, well, it's been hard or whatever, that's kind of like the invitation, I think, that people need to start saying, well, what happened? And it's, I know it's not talked about and it's considered maybe taboo about talking about these things, but most people are going through something that's not great. And I think that everyone puts it as motherhood is so great. And mind you, it is great, but there's so many hard things about it. And motherhood is just, it's a consistent job of, and there's no, like, there's no paperwork or guidelines on how this is going to go, what's right, what's wrong. And for your first, it's going to be completely different than your second. And it's hard when you're comparing your children to one to another. And there's just so many things that people don't realize, that these conversations need to be had and people need to hear them so that this is becoming a norm, right?
As a support system, I think we could be better at assuming that someone who's just had a baby is probably not doing well, right? Like, I don't know how many times someone said to me, oh, how are you doing today? And I'm like, great. And meanwhile, I had the crappiest day, but I don't want to be that person. I think if we just as a support system got better and knowing that if you've just had a baby, and if you're pregnant for that matter, same thing, the likeliness is you're probably not doing great. Do something that can help that person, even if it's just going over and washing their dishes. Something so simple. I remember one of my old clients, she used to be really upset. She had a glass kitchen table and she was always frustrated on how dirty it was. And every time I worked for her, that was overnight, I would always wash that table. It didn't matter if I got nothing else done, but I would go and Windex that table. And the way she came down in the morning, seeing that table nice and clean, it just made her feel amazing. So I think as a support system, we just should need to be better at knowing that if someone just had a baby, they probably need you. Go and help them. And of course, don't invade their space or overstep. But that job jar I mentioned, as parents, let's start doing the job jars and telling people how they can help us. Take that help graciously because we need it. And then as support people, don't assume that someone's doing amazing because, you know, even in our own lives, right? I'm seeing you guys in this little square box. We're using social media and we assume that everything outside those box look as great as what we see in the box. It's not. You know, all the mess that's happening is likely that it's happening to everyone. Social media, unfortunately, has made it a little bit worse because now we're seeing things and assuming that, you know, why is she doing so great and I'm not? But as support people, let's just start stepping in and really being helpful because that village is so important more than anyone thinks. And every single person needs it.
Oh, I completely agree with that. And so going back to the job jar, what other techniques do you have or other suggestions do you have for new moms?
Oh, I have a lot. I have a lot of tips that I give them. I have, so food, that's a big one. During pregnancy, think about what you're going to be eating when the baby comes. So thinking about how packed your day is when you don't have a baby. And now the baby's coming and that baby's going to take about 20 hours of your time a day. How do you get everything else done? So going through your list of things you need to do in a day and figuring out once the baby comes, how are we doing this? What things do I have to do? What things can I delegate to my partner? Or maybe we have to hire people to do. What things maybe don't need to be done or done as often? Things like cooking, pre-cook things in advance. I had a client that did something I thought was ingenious, but they had a party at their house before the babies were having triplets, before the babies were born. And they had all their friends come over. They had set up about 10 different recipes and they spent the entire day with their friends and family cooking. And they kept all the food. So it was just like a last hurrah before the babies came, but they pre-planned all of their meals and had their friends come and help them do all the cooking. There are outside companies now that can actually cook for you. There are some that specialize in new moms and specifically breastfeeding moms. So thinking about that stuff and having that stuff maybe brought in or done in advance, hiring help. So if you do value and you can afford postpartum help once the baby comes, hire someone, look into your insurance to see if it covers that help. The help should be educated, by the way. You probably can get cheaper help or free help, but having someone educated that's not going to judge you is going to be really valuable, even if it's only once a week. Have them come in and help support you in those first early few weeks. I do something in the beginning as well with clothes. So I teach parents to, once you get all your baby clothes for every age, wash a few, especially of the early ones, because you both know how quickly babies grow. Wash a few pieces of each size and throw them in a labeled bin and put them inside the baby's closet. Once the baby has grown out of that few, wash those, put them back in the bin, in the age-appropriate bin, and pull out the next size that are ready to go. But I see parents getting 3 million outfits, all of 0 to 3 months, ripping off all the tags, washing everything, putting it all in drawers, and they don't even use 50% because the baby grew too fast. So just take a few of each size and then pull them out as you need them. So that's one, is the bins. And a big one as well is having your sleeping, feeding, and changing stations on both floors if you live in a two-story. So upstairs would be a bassinet or crib, change table, and obviously their drawers. But downstairs, having Rubbermaid drawers or a playpen with a co-sleeper on the top, something that you can use on a main floor that you can sleep the baby, change the baby, a feeding station where you'll be able to sit and feed, whether it's bottle or breast. Because what parents don't realize is, especially if you've had tearing or a C-section, you are not going to be walking up and downstairs all day long with the baby. So make sure you prepare yourself with two different stations. And for those breastfeeding parents, having a bin by your breastfeeding area of your remote, some water, magazines, your phone, some granola bars, give that task to your partner or whoever's helping you to make sure that that's always filled. Because I see so many moms that sit down at the chair, takes them 20 to 30 minutes to finally get baby to latch on. And then they realize they didn't eat or drink anything all day. And now they're like, how do I get up to get it? So always having that little bin beside you with some snacks and some water to keep you hydrated and nourished during the breastfeeding.
Yeah, those are all really good tips, actually. And I think that a lot of new moms, and even like moms that are seasoned moms, like every child is different. I think that you always just need that little refresh of like, okay, because like even when my daughter's just turned a year, but I still start thinking like, newborn phase. I don't even remember that anymore. I don't know if I've like blacked it out, but I'm like, wait, how many hours does a baby sleep? Like, I just start forgetting, right? And it's funny because somebody said to me, like, what do you need with your second child? And I would say, like, we have absolutely everything, even though they're different genders. Like, I did a lot of gender neutral stuff for my first, so I was lucky, but we had everything. And my one friend actually was like, well, why don't I like give you money towards postpartum doula or like help, hired help? And like you said, educated help is so different, because somebody who's your friend, for example, or somebody who's going to be cheaper, they don't necessarily know what to do. And somebody who's experienced in it, they know when a mom says, oh no, you don't need to do anything, like just sit here and maybe talk to me. It's like, no, maybe we'll talk while I do your dishes. Or like even like me and Dana, for example, if our kids are like being crazy all day, we're like, okay, let's just do dinner together. Because for some reason, our kids are so well behaved when they're together and they don't cry. They don't want us 100 times in 1 hour when they're playing and they're out of their own environment, to say. And those kind of things help so much. But when you don't know what somebody needs and you're trying to help, but you don't know how to help, it's also really hard.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think having help from family is great if you've got that, but you have to be really good at telling them what you need, right? Whereas the professional's going to come in, they're getting paid to do this. So we're going to help you. I don't want to sit on your couch and hold your baby for 8 hours. Like, what can I do to make your day better? So we generally know what types of things, like baby laundry and washing your dishes and loading and unloading your dishwasher, sterilizing your breastfeeding equipment and all that stuff. And we do the same thing for baby showers. If somebody has everything, we will start a link where families can donate and give money to you to get postpartum help for that exact reason, because sometimes that's more valuable than having a new outfit, right? We all want to give something. So I agree to that point for sure.
And what do these packages look like? If someone wanted to reach out to a perinatal support worker, is there certain packages they have to purchase, or how does that work?
We're really customized to what you want. So we have packages that will reduce the price. But if a family reaches out and they just want one shift, 4 hours, 4 hours our minimum during the day, 8 hours is our minimum overnight. Then we would just do one shift. Some parents need that. Some parents just need one night of sleep so that they can do another 4 months, and that's fine too. Most families do something like 3 times a week for 8 weeks. That usually gets them the education they need, gets them the help, gets them to a point where maybe the baby's sleeping a little bit more of a chunk, and they can often do it on their own. Our job is to work ourselves out of a job. So that is the key, is making sure that we're leaving parents in a place where they can now do it on their own and feel really good about that.
And then, so per hour, how much is it?
Depending on the professional you're hiring, it's usually anywhere between $40 and $50 an hour. So it's not inexpensive, but that's where things like donations from family and friends will help. Sometimes your insurance, that's a big one. All the insurances are different and your plan is different. So calling them and ask them if you have PSW support, personal support worker support, will get you PNSW coverage, doula support, or even nursing support. Nursing support often is for babies who have any kind of medical issue, but the insurance will often cover that as well.
And even though I know it is expensive and I know it's like not necessarily, I mean, some people would say it's a luxury, but I think it's like a basic need for all mothers. If that would be covered, that would be great. But I think that a lot of people don't realize the same thing goes for therapy. Like you put your money into it, right? And it's expensive. But when you look at the long-term outcomes of things, of like your partner needing to take off months of leave, for example, your mental health is deteriorating, you can't function, and now your toddler needs so many more other aspects in their life, and it really is an investment, but it's an investment into being the best family unit you can be, opposed to just, oh, I'm just hiring some extra help. And you know, like these people are there to help you and they're there to guide you to be able to do this on your own. And I think that is really important for people to understand that it is expensive, but what do you value your family as, right?
Yeah, and the receipts that we give you anyways, our company, they are tax deductible, so you can use them through your taxes as well when you do your write-offs. But we are no more expensive than a 1 week all-inclusive trip for two. And how many
Yes.
people are going on those? Right? So thinking about that, call this your baby moon if you have to. But truthfully, it is an investment in you as parents. It's an investment in your children. It's an investment not only to have the help, but to have the education throughout that, because we have more prep for a driver's license than we do for having a baby. And unless you're the type of parent going to look for the extra training, and I'm not talking about training like on TikTok or Instagram, because I know we all use that. That's not the best training. That's just someone's advice. Even the prenatal classes that you're taking, I will say, full disclosure, when we teach classes for a specific institutions, we are told what to say and not to say. They are very filtered. So we teach classes as our own company classes. Those classes, you are getting all the information, all the stuff that the institutions don't want you to know. Those are the types of classes that you want, the ones that are unfiltered, that are going to give you all the information for pregnancy and birth and postpartum, so that you can again take that information and make the best decision for you and your family. So definitely the money invested is going to make your entire experience so much better. And this is the thing we tell the insurance companies, is if you would just pay a little bit in advance to help these families in the beginning and be proactive, you will be saving a lot of money down the road on mental health, divorces, medication, all those things that come down the road because we didn't give parents that help in the beginning.
And where would someone go to find this unfiltered parenting classes?
Well, we teach them. I don't know where you would find them elsewhere. You'd have to do your homework. But if you come to our website, the classes that we teach, we have group classes, we have private one-on-one classes, and we have them online as well. Those, we give you all of the information. When we teach them in different institutions, I can't share those obviously, but when we teach them in different institutions, you're kind of getting an overview and certain things that we've been told not to lie, but not to share. And we really feel like if you're not sharing everything, then you're not being truthful. You're not really giving them all the options.
Yeah, and I think that's what people need to understand is important, that like even when you go to specific things, that they might not be the whole truth or the whole picture of things, especially when you're not looking at like a holistic approach. Like my nurse, when I had my first child, is different than I have now, but she would actually email me all kinds of things, especially because it was COVID. And I think she knew, well, she obviously knew that I was struggling with postpartum anxiety. She would send me so many things that were paid, some were free, some were also things that you paid for, but you can apply for assistance from people who donate to it. And there's just so many different routes that people don't understand and they don't know about. And she would just go out of her way on her own time and just email me so many different resources. And I was so thankful for that. And I mean, mind you, I probably only used one or two, but it was because she consistently sent them to me. I was like, okay, maybe I'll just try it. And I think it was after maybe the 10th or 11th email, I was like saying to her, like, why are you keep sending me these things? She's like, well, maybe one day you'll see something that looks good to you and you will try it and it will be helpful. And it was.
That's good. That's good that she invested that amount of time, because it's rare. And sometimes as parents, we don't know, like even that, you know, I will tell you, with our clients, we do the mental health, like the Edinburgh assessment for mental health. We tell our clients that we do those regularly throughout our time with them. Because if we don't, and we suddenly say, here's the Edinburgh mental health test, they start to wonder, why did you notice something? Like, why are they giving me this test? So if we make it a norm, then they don't question our motives. So saying the fact that the nurse was providing you all that information and you use it when you needed it was probably great for you, because you got to pull on that when you decided now was the time. Unfortunately, even those nurse, you know, the government nursing visits, they're really short. And sometimes they don't even come to your house. They give you a phone call. They just do, you know, how are you? And you say, I'm great. And they're like, that's great. Thanks for answering the phone. But truthfully, there's so much more happening behind there that we're missing. That's the other value behind having professional help in the home, is that we are trained on mental health and assessing that, so we can screen. If we see parents having some issues or that we suspect something's going on, we can bring that up to the partner. We can talk to the parent, the mom or the parent about it. So even just having someone else in the home recognizing some of these signs can really bring forward some issues that might be happening that otherwise would be overlooked.
Yeah. And I think it's important too. So when I had my second, I had so many issues with her tongue tie, torticollis, colic, all these things. So we actually had a public health nurse come in 3 times. And I didn't even know that was a thing. Like, they came for free, but I was lucky because I had the same one. And when she was hearing my story and stuff, she was like, well, I think I should connect with all these other people. And she connected me with some really great free resources, but they're very limited, right? So you only get so many sessions or whatever, right? But I think that when people start realizing that these things are there, they start wondering, okay, well, maybe I could accept help. Maybe I could accept going to a group, or, you know, maybe these won't be so bad because nobody's talking about them. Nobody's saying, oh, I went to a postpartum anxiety group today and it was great. Like, nobody talks about that. And I don't think I've ever met somebody who's openly said to me, oh, I go to group therapy, or I go to these groups that help me with breastfeeding.
Yeah, we're getting a lot better with that, which is good. I've noticed that in the last few years, we are getting a lot better about sharing stuff like that. But I think it's just the words we use, right? Let's start changing could to should, right? Like, those are the big things where we really need to start making these not, they are not a testament to our success, right? If a mom needed help in the first year versus a mom who didn't, it doesn't make you a better parent or not. I think that's the key, is we need to, you know, what you guys are doing with this podcast, which is really letting people be enlightened that parenting kind of sucks sometimes. And it's okay to like tell people that I'm not having fun doing this. This is crap. And I say that in my first year with my 3, I survived it, but I didn't enjoy it. I didn't get to savor it. It sucked. I wish I could go back and do it again with everything that I know now. I'm sure I would be like 100 times better, but we can only deal with what we have in the moment, do the best we can. And I think we just need to get it out there to the new and expecting parents, get the help, ask for the help, be honest, and find the people that are going to support you, not the people that are going to judge you. They're not the ones that you want in your immediate circle anyway.
And I think those are all great points. And I think we touched upon a lot of different things in the podcast here today. So before we wrap it up, I just want to leave the floor to you. Is there anything else you want to add for the listeners?
Oh my gosh, 21 years of information. I think I've shared a lot. The only thing that I didn't say is that I tell everyone is stop going to Dr. Google and Dr. Facebook. And now Dr. TikTok apparently has a degree as well. So stop going to them. As much as you can get some good information, I do tell people, find two people you trust. Two, whether they're family, friends, professionals, find two people you really trust and go to those people. And if you're looking for parenting advice, don't ask every single person what they did. Find someone who has children older than yours, that you feel like what they did as parents is how you want to see your journey, and talk to those parents. There's no point talking to other parents whose kids aren't behaving the way you necessarily would want your kids to behave, right? So go find two, a maximum of three people you trust, and let those be your mentors when it comes to parenting.
Yeah, those are amazing. Those are amazing tips and advice. But thank you so much for joining us, Debbie. We really appreciate being able to share everything that you know.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our time together. I'm sure we could have talked for another hour on this.
We might have to have you on again.
It's that topic, right? Where it's just like a never-ending cycle of I can't stop talking about this. And it's nice when you have the same aspect or same outlook as other people, right?
I agree. It's the one time I think that we are getting a little better talking about our traumas. I feel like birth in itself and parenting in itself is traumatic in some sense. And it's amazing to see when we start talking about our birth or parenting journeys, how much depth and information comes out of it. So the more we can talk about this and encourage others to do the same, the better the future parents are going to have it.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much again, Debbie. We really appreciate your time with us. And perhaps in the future, we'll have you on again, because you do have a wealth of knowledge and you do have so many different certificates in many different things. And we'd love to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And thanks again, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next Friday at 7 p.m.
Thanks for listening to my mommies, and I really love you so much.